There are a lot of people out there hurting economically right now because of the COVID-19 outbreak. Some people are still in decent shape. You might have an emergency fund. You might have the ability to pause payments with things like your mortgage or put off payments that you owe. But some people were in dire straits before this happened, and or even in worse straits now. So this episode is made specifically for people who are dealing with student loan default. So if you are not in default and never will be in default on your student loan debt, then please pass this episode along to somebody who is dealing with that. Also, if this will be a really interesting episode for you, if you have ever thought about default or if you wanted to know what happens to your student loans when you stop paying, you know, what kind of powers do private lenders or the government have to make your life, you know, not so great or even miserable. So this is going to be a pretty interesting show, and it's really intended for people who are dealing with really frustrating, difficult times to get actionable information from real student loan attorneys who are friends of mine. And I think that they're really excellent at what they do. So go ahead and listen to today's episode with realizing also this is not legal advice. You have to contact and hire an attorney to have a client, attorney-client relationship. So with that said, I just wanted to introduce today's show. I think you're going to find it really, really helpful if you're in default on anything or if you know somebody who is. Today, I've got two extremely, sophisticated, established, genius guests today. We've got Jay Fleischman and Adam Minsky. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Travis. Way to build up my ego, huh?
I know, right? I feel great.
I was looking for distinguished. I think that was the word I was grasping for, but then I just blanked and I couldn't remember the word distinguished.
I'll take genius.
I'll take sophisticated. I mean, I'm okay with being sophisticated. That works for me.
Yeah, that works too.
Yeah. So specifically, Jay, you're with MoneyWise Law. Adam, you're with the Boston Student Loan Lawyer. So why don't I let you both just introduce yourselves to our listeners?
Adam, age before beauty.
Wow. Fine, I'll take it. My name is Adam Minsky. I am an attorney. My practice is focused entirely on helping student loan borrowers and their families. I'm physically based in Boston, and I'm licensed to practice in Massachusetts and New York.
And my name is Jay Fleischman. I am a consumer protection attorney who's been, I realized not terribly long ago, I've been doing this for 25 years, which makes me feel so old. I've got offices in New York as well as in Los Angeles, and I am licensed practice in New York and California.
Well, I knew you guys were legit and student loan geniuses when I met you at this conference called FinCon, which is a place where a lot of financial personalities and bloggers, writers, et cetera, gather once a year. We were on this student loan panel together, and I'll never forget this. You had this like discussion as to why this private student loan company offered, I think it was Adam, maybe one of your clients, some sort of settlement. You were kind of trying to figure out why they offered a settlement that was so good. And then Jay was like, wait a second, this obscure statute based off of X, Y, and Z or something means that they probably don't owe the debt at all in this particular case. And just watching you guys go back and forth and debating the private student loan settlement nuances that are out there, I was just thinking, wow, these guys really know this super weird area of law that not a lot of people practice well. What about student loan law excited you, got you into this? Like, what was your process of going from a law school graduate to being student loan lawyers?
I graduated law school in 2010 with a bunch of student loans, and I was lucky enough to have a job at the time, but I had student loan debt, and I actually encountered a problem with one of my loan servicers. Long story short, it was an incredibly frustrating experience, and eventually I got to the point where I thought I needed some assistance, some outside assistance, and I went to try to find that outside assistance and couldn't find anyone because there was no one in Massachusetts, at least, who did this type of work. So I wound up figuring out the problem on my own, but in the process of that, I realized that there's kind of a need for this type of counsel and assistance. That I graduated with a lot of other folks who also had student loan debt. They were going through similar struggles. So I started my practice as basically a part-time side gig, providing counsel and advice to people I knew and people who they knew on how to deal with their student loans. I learned a lot in the process, but what started off as a part-time side job became essentially a second full-time job. And then I did, you know, wind up transitioning to doing this entirely. And that's what I've been doing ever since professionally. So I didn't go to law school to become a student loan lawyer, but I became one right out of law school, and I've been one ever since.
What about you, Jay?
Well, I actually started as a consumer bankruptcy lawyer. And when I started practicing in 1995, you were able to discharge student loans in bankruptcy, provided that they had been in repayment for a period of 7 years or more. And it wasn't until 1998 that that time limitation was taken away, at least for federal student loans. And at the time, I was working with a client who also had fairly significant federal student loans as a result of coming out of a well-known music school located in the Northeast, and also had significant tax debts. And we were trying to time out her bankruptcy to be able to maximize the benefit that she was going to get. Then in October of 1998, suddenly we realized that, and there wasn't very much heads up time before the law changed in 1998. Most bankruptcy lawyers didn't realize that the law had changed until after it had changed. But I was aware of it in the lead up to it. And it started making me ask the question of, what else was available for student loans, given the fact that bankruptcy seemed to have so many roadblocks? And even though at the time it wasn't something that I was really closely following, it did spark a number of questions. And ultimately, it was in 2004 that I kind of got dragged into some of these issues on behalf of another client. And it kind of steamrolled from there. And I've been focusing almost primarily on the issues that student loan borrowers face for, it'll be 8 years out of my 25. So that's how I got pulled into it.
Yeah, I think we'll go bounce questions between the two of you guys. And if one of you wants to jump in on a question I didn't ask you, feel free to, okay? So the first question I've got, Jay, is this bankruptcy issue with student loans. A lot of people want to know, why can't I discharge my student loans in bankruptcy? Right? What's the simple answer to that? Why can't I just, you know, say I've got $300,000 of loans, I'm making $50,000 as a chiropractor, why can't I just declare bankruptcy and wipe that all away?
Because that's not the way that the bankruptcy code is structured. At this point, in order to be able to discharge a student loan in bankruptcy, that requires a separate legal action filed against the student loan lenders and student loan holders in bankruptcy court that would run alongside of your main bankruptcy case. That lawsuit is called an adversary proceeding, and it requires the borrower to be able to prove that an undue hardship exists. And though there is more than one standard that's at work, but for the most part, the standard that's at work is called the Brunner test, based upon a case called Brunner versus New York State Higher Education that came out of New York that requires a three-part showing. First, that the borrower's current income and expenses don't enable them to repay their student loan and also be able to take care of themselves and their dependents. The second showing is that's required under Brunner is that the current state of financial affairs is likely to persist into the indefinite future due to no fault of the borrower. And that's really the critical part of it. It's one thing to say, this is what my life is going to look like going forward. It is something completely different to say, this is what my life is going to look like going forward, and there is absolutely nothing that I can do to change that. And then the third showing that's required is that the borrower has made good faith attempts to repay the debt leading up to the filing of this adversary proceeding. It is a standard that is not uniformly applied. As you can tell, a lot of the wording that I just gave you is subject to interpretation. Different judges interpret it different ways, different courthouses. In fact, different judges in the same court will often interpret the standard in remarkably different ways. So it's not impossible, but it does require the right set of facts and circumstances.
Yeah. So I don't know if Adam does this, but Jay, do you look at someone's, you know, hobbies and political party affiliations or neighborhood, to see, you know, I don't know, like to decide which judge to bring a case with?
Well, unfortunately, in bankruptcy, there's very little ability to what's called forum shop. You don't get to choose your judge. You file the case where you file the case and the judge is assigned whoever the judge is. So I wish that we could strategically move around a little bit more than we can. I can't say that I look at what my clients' hobbies or political affiliations are. That being said, there have been cases not too long in the past where a discharge has been denied for a client who, say, smokes cigarettes, because that is looked at as an expense. Obviously, it's a household expense for somebody who does smoke, but some judges have looked at that and said, well, that's an expense that you can cut out. And by cutting out that expense, that makes you more likely to be able to repay the student loans. There was a case a couple of years ago where somebody happened to eat fast food more often than might otherwise be the case. And the judge looked at that and said, well, there's no reason why you have to eat fast food. You can make your food at home and you can cut your expenses. Those are extreme examples, of course. And even over the course of the past very few years, a lot of judges have started to have their attitudes evolved, I can say. So those are extreme, but those problems do exist. And it's very much a case-specific situation.
Adam, we have a lot of people that are in default and they're having their tax refunds seized, right? Or they have their wages garnished on federal loans. You know, if you're looking at rehabilitation versus consolidation as a cure for someone's default problem, which do you look at and why?
Yeah, sure. So just to be clear, so federal student loans that are in default, there are statutory programs that can allow borrowers to cure or reverse the default and bring those loans back to good standing. These programs are typically restricted to federal loans only, one of which is rehabilitation, which is a temporary monthly payment program lasting a minimum of 9 months, after which the loans are brought out of default. And then the other is consolidation, which is a program through the Department of Education that allows borrowers to basically take out a new loan through the Department of Ed, pays off the defaulted loans, and then they wind up in good standing on the new consolidation loan. Each is different in terms of pros and cons. So which one is best for a borrower really depends on, I think, their circumstances as well as their priorities. So for instance, one of the main benefits of rehabilitation is a unique credit reporting outcome where completing rehabilitation results in the reference to the loan being in default. That gets deleted from the credit report after the borrower completes the program. It doesn't delete every, you know, negative piece of information. It just deletes the reference to it being in default. The history of missed payments and all that, that stays for up to 7 years. But it also takes 9 months to go through that process. Consolidation can be done in as little as 30 to 60 days. The credit report outcome is good, but it's not necessarily quite as good as rehabilitation. The underlying loans get reported as paid in full. So just right there, we have two competing priorities or considerations. If the borrower's main priority is timing or speed, I need to get this resolved ASAP, that makes consolidation possibly a better choice. On the other hand, if the borrower's credit report is the most important, I want to get the best possible credit report I can, that might make rehabilitation a better choice. It also depends on exactly what's going on with their loans. For instance, if there's a wage garnishment order in effect, in most cases, the borrower will not be able to consolidate with some exceptions. Whereas with rehabilitation, you can still rehabilitate if you're in an active garnishment. It just might be more expensive because you have to pay on top of the garnishment for a portion of that rehabilitation plan. It also might matter if the borrower has multiple loans with multiple holders. If that's the case, then that might make consolidation more attractive because you can solve everything all at once, at least potentially. Whereas with rehabilitation, you'd have to negotiate a separate rehabilitation plan with each separate loan holder. So there is no one size fits all. I think it's really important that borrowers understand the full universe of options, the pros and cons of each option, and which option best aligns with their circumstances and their goals. That's where people like me and Jay, I think, can really come in handy and advise people what best fits their situation.
Most people that are in default on federal student loans because federal student loans are the most common. But yeah, people might be in default on private and federal because you can have both. But I guess federal is probably, if somebody's in default, it's more likely they're in default on mostly all federal loans than private loans. Would you disagree with that or agree with that?
I don't know. I mean, I've seen people in default on federal, not private. I've seen people in default on private, not federal. I've seen people in default on everything. I've seen people in good standing and everything. So I don't have data to back up exactly what the breakdown might be. Certainly, you are correct that there's a lot more federal student loans out there cumulatively than private loans. But also, federal student loans have a lot more in the way of flexibility, a lot more in the way of hardship options, a lot more flexibility to adjust your payments, which doesn't really exist for private loans. So in some ways, private loans are more easy to default on. So I don't actually know exactly whether it's more common or not to default on one loan type versus the other.
Gee, what did he mean by that? What did he mean by it's easier to default on private loans versus federal?
Well, federal student loans provide for a period of delinquency prior to default. And that default will typically be at 270 days on a direct loan, and I believe it's 330 days on the FFEL, federally guaranteed loans. Up until the time that the loan goes into default, however, the borrower has opportunities to catch up on their payments merely by paying the arrears and any late fees and be able to continue on. And so in that respect, federal student loans provide an enormous amount of opportunity and wiggle room to avoid default. Private student loan default, however, is controlled entirely by the terms of the promissory note. And most promissory notes provide that once you've missed a payment and your payment goes 30 days past due, that the loan can be called in default. And certain lenders allow that to go a little bit longer than that. But more often than not, you're going to see the loan go into default at 30, 60, 90, or even 180 days past due.
You know, in terms of negotiating something, why can you sometimes negotiate a really attractive settlement for a client for a private loan, but not a federal loan?
Okay, I'll start the answer on this one. In my experience, private student loans are governed by a statute of limitations, which is a state-by-state matter. And a statute of limitations limits the amount of time that a creditor of any sort can bring legal action to force the borrower or debtor, as the term may be used, to repay that debt. In the absence of legal action, however, the creditor can't force the borrower to make payments. Federal student loans have no statute of limitations. Federal student loans remain outstanding until either they're paid off in full or discharged or forgiven, but private student loans have a ticking clock. For that reason, as much as a borrower doesn't want to default on their private student loans, I don't know many, if any, borrowers who want to default on any obligation, unless they have absolutely no choice but to do so. Though the borrower doesn't want to default, the lender is also very aware of that clock. And so they're far more likely to be in a position to come to the table and negotiate a resolution of that debt. Of course, in addition, federal student loan settlement is called compromise, just as in offering compromise for federal income tax debts. And compromise is governed by federal regulations, whereas private student loans are governed by the lender and the borrower. It's a private negotiation. It's a private deal. And whatever's going to work is going to work. And so there's a lot less constraint in that respect.
Does Massachusetts and New York have the same statute of limitations, Adam? Or are they different?
They're mostly the same. It's generally 6 years, this is for private loans, and that starts running as of the date of either the default or the date of the most recent payment. Certain language in the promissory note in Massachusetts can potentially extend the term out to be longer, depending on exactly what the contract states and the lender's position. And then ultimately, that's likely a dispute that would have to be resolved by a judge. A lot of contracts also have what's called a governing law provision, which states that the law of a certain state governs, regardless of where the borrower lives at the time that a suit is filed or where the suit actually gets filed. And then whether or not that governing law provision actually does govern or not will also come down to state law and a judge's interpretation. So sometimes the statute of limitations is pretty straightforward. Other times it's not. And when borrowers are trying to navigate that and trying to figure out how best to proceed, whether to settle, whether to litigate, these are the considerations that come into play.
Let's pull both of you. I like to tell people to fix their default right away, because usually people that have federal student loans that are in default have bad credit for other reasons, at least what I've found. It's not just the student loan. Usually if they're struggling, there might be some late credit card debt. There might be some other things going on. sometimes this is one of the reasons why I like to refer a lot of our default cases to you guys, is because I don't want to give somebody wrong information. But I mean, you said, you know, it's obviously better to do a rehabilitation than a consolidation because that event comes off of the credit report. Like if you're just looking at credit only, like if you're just looking at your credit score, you'd rather do rehabilitation. Is that right?
It's such a case-by-case analysis. I definitely would not say that one option is always better than the other, right? So even if credit report is the most important consideration, it doesn't necessarily mean that rehabilitation is the way to go. So for instance, if the default occurred more than 7.5 years ago, then it might not even be showing up on the borrower's credit report any longer, which means that there is no unique credit benefit to rehabilitating, in which case it might just make sense to consolidate because it's faster. Again, if there are multiple loans with multiple loan holders, and that means you have to do multiple rehabilitation plans, just the sheer tediousness of that and the effort that would have to go into that might mean that rehabilitation is not the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, most of the people we see try rehabilitation, they fall off the wagon. You know, you have to make 9 monthly payments and they have to be consecutive, right? I mean, this is, we just see people kind of anecdotally that just aren't successful with that, even though you can make a $5 payment if your income is low enough. The consolidation just seems to me have to have a way higher success rate for fixing the problem of being in default and getting signed up for, you know, revised pay as you earn or something like that. I mean, is that, do you see that, or do you see equal success of both of these options for fixing federal student loans in default?
From my perspective, and I'm sure Jay would agree, we are counseling borrowers and representing borrowers usually through the process. So I think what we see may not be indicative of what happens for borrowers who don't have someone sort of in their corner. I do know that there is a lot of concern, and I have seen this a lot, where borrowers do successfully rehabilitate, but then they fall back into default again, often because their loans, when they come out of default, they're transferred to a new servicer, and they might never get the new correspondence from the new servicer informing them that they now have to set up new payments with the new loan servicer, and then they go back into default. And when that happens, you can't rehabilitate a second time if you've already successfully rehabilitated it. But I've also seen that happen with consolidation. So it kind of cuts both ways. I don't know, Jay, what your experiences are with that, but I'm sure.
Yeah, that's similar. Exactly my experience. I think the primary source of the problem, both in rehabilitation as well as in consolidation, is that the borrower very often has no idea who the players are, what the difference is between, in the case of a FEEL loan, the guarantee agency and the debt collector and the servicer, and the differences among each one of the servicers. And sometimes what we'll see is a loan that started out with one particular servicer rehabilitates, and then the borrower consolidates with the same originating servicer being assigned, but the borrower hasn't perhaps consolidated all of their loans. And confusion reigns, I think.
So it sounds like to me that the smart thing to do for most people in default on federal student loans is just to consolidate it and go through that studentaid.gov application where they're just going to send that to a servicer, sign up for IDR payment plans at the same time, and just like get it out and fix it fast. I mean, do you think that that's right or wrong in most cases?
I think that more often than not, particularly with respect to a credit reporting issue, I think that more often than not, consolidation is the better way to go because A, it is faster. B, it's one of the only times that the borrower has any level of control in the servicer that's going to be assigned to their loan. From a credit reporting issue, and I run into this all the time, Adam, I'm sure that you do as well, where a borrower wants to improve their credit score for a particular reason, or home purchase or something else along those lines. And when you go through a rehabilitation, yeah, it's 9 months and then the default is going to be removed from your credit report, but that's still 9 months at minimum that you're still in default. And then above and beyond that, you've got to establish that positive payment history after that 9 months is completed. So the default comes off, but the pre-default delinquency doesn't, unless it's more than 7.5 years old. Compare that with a consolidation that'll take anywhere between normally 60, 90 days max, and the borrower can immediately begin making new payments and establish that positive payment history such that a year in, the borrower who's consolidated may very well be in a better credit reporting position than the one that's gone the rehabilitation route.
Yeah, so it seems like the thing that you could really need to watch out for with defaulted loans would be if somebody has like 5 to 10 years of credit towards an income-based repayment plan already. Because if you did that, then you would not get, if you consolidated it, you would lose that 5 to 10 years of credit. And if you did rehabilitation, you would keep that credit on forgiveness. Does that sound correct?
Yes. I mean, so that is, again, another ingredient to this stew of decision-making that people have to make. If you have accrued progress towards existing loan forgiveness, for instance, if you have direct loans, you made 5 years of progress towards public service loan forgiveness, and then you defaulted on those loans, you definitely, well, not definitely, but you probably don't want to consolidate because you'll be erasing those 5 years that you've already accrued towards public service loan forgiveness. So you might want to rehabilitate, even though it takes longer. You want to preserve that progress. So absolutely, that's another factor that has to be considered.
Jay?
I agree. I've got nothing to add to that at all.
Whoa. I asked a lawyer for an opinion and didn't get a long response. You know?
What do you think, Travis? What do you say?
That's so funny. So federal student loans, it seems like the smart thing to do is to go to studentaid.gov and to try to apply to consolidate. And if I have defaulted student loans, a lot of times they're at a collections agency. Will I still see all the loans eligible for consolidation on my studentaid.gov when I log into that or no?
You should. And again, this might be me being too lawyerly, but again, I'm not endorsing rehab over consolidation or consolidation over rehab as a general point. I think it really does come down to a case by case issue. If you want to consolidate, yes, you can do that online at studentaid.gov. There is a consolidation application that is available there. You do have to select an income-driven payment plan for the consolidation. That's another thing that has to be analyzed. Which payment plan is best for you? Parent plus borrowers are more restricted in the types of income-driven plans they can access. Being married will obviously impact what your payments will be. Your tax filing status as a married borrower will also impact things, what documentation of income that you use. So all of that has to be factored in before you proceed in submitting an application. But yes, it can be done online. For borrowers who want to rehabilitate, that has to be done directly through the loan holder or their contracted debt collection agency. So the Department of Ed, for instance, usually outsources debt collectors to a variety of companies, you know, private debt collection agencies that the borrower would have to work with.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because, like, don't you guys think that part of the problem with this is, like, if I go into default, maybe my loan started off at Sallie Mae or Navient or somebody like that, and then it gets transferred or moved. Maybe they had it with direct loan servicing or something, and then it moves somewhere else. And then they default after 5 years of trying to make payments, and then it goes to a new collections agency. And then, oh, by the way, they have some private loans at a different place that now got transferred to a different collections agency. So within only like a few years' time, you had all of your loans go to like 3 or 5 different companies. And, you know, especially if you are at all from a disadvantaged background, you know, if you're changing residences a lot, if you don't have consistent access to the internet, like, I mean, that's something that I kind of took for granted, but you're seeing with this COVID outbreak, like there's this digital divide, right? Where a lot of people don't have access to a lot of the things people take for granted. So, I mean, it just seems like student loan default is kind of a mess because student loans are a mess. I mean, do you think that student loans and default issues are, I mean, were they ever better? Has it always been this bad? I guess we should ask Jay that question because you've been at this for a little longer.
Yeah, Jay, tell us how things were years and years and years ago.
Back in my day, I walked uphill both ways to school. Interestingly enough, it was always a mess. I graduated from law school in 1994 when dinosaurs roamed the face of the earth. And in 1995 is when ICR came into play. And that's the granddaddy first income-driven repayment plan. I did not have undergraduate student loans, but I did have student loans from law school, and they were assigned to Sallie Mae. And it was so incredibly difficult for me to understand how my loans could possibly be handled. And it started out, quite frankly, with probably the dumbest thing ever. I had a payment of X dollars. I happen to have had a good month that month. When I came out of law school, I was doing a variety of things. I made a double payment on my loan, and then I didn't get a bill the next month because Sallie Mae just took the next month and they advanced the payments. And they still do that. Navient still does that. They all do. But they never bothered to tell me. I didn't get a bill. And then I made a couple of more payments and they were kind of spotty. I wasn't really paying attention. I woke up one day. Well, didn't wake up, but I got the mail one day and I got a letter from my guarantee agency telling me that my loan was going into default. I had no idea whatsoever. And I had no means of understanding how to get myself out of default. And I read letters when they show up. I may not be the genius that you call me, but I like to think that I can understand the written language. It's incredibly complex for even the most savvy borrower. I think that a lot of the problem arises from the complexity of the landscape, the fact that the student loan universe has never changed. It's never been scuttled and rebuilt from the ground up, much like the Internal Revenue Code. The government just builds more layers onto it, trying to make it easier. But of course, each layer adds another significant amount of complexity. I think that a lot of that comes from that problem.
Yeah. So like, what do you think about the future, right? So there's a lot of these calls to make the student loans bankruptable again. Say that happens. I mean, do you think that we're going to see this world where older student loans are not bankruptable? Or do you think they'll be able to figure out a way to include some of these other private loans or federal loans that are older that they might be able to make them bankruptible? I mean, what are your thoughts?
You know, if they change the bankruptcy code, unless they restrict it to loans that were dispersed as of a certain date, it would presumably be open to anyone with any types of student loans. As Jay said, often what they do with student loan reform is changes only apply to loans taken out as of a certain date. I honestly don't know what the end result would be. I could foresee some sort of disbursement date restriction as a compromise to kind of get enough buy-in to make it passable if it doesn't have sufficient support for a more open-ended type of legal reform. But it doesn't have to be that way. We'll have to see.
My baseline assumption is that eventually you're going to see pay-as-you-earn open for everyone, and everyone will be able to do 10% of your income unless it's like an FFEL loan. And then I think you're going to see no tax bomb. Like, I feel like the Biden plan kind of came out recently, and he was talking about, you know, including student loans and bankruptcy and making people be able to pay 5% of their incomes. I feel like that's going to be kind of like a negotiating thing where they're probably going to settle on 10% instead of 5%. That's necessarily default related. It's just sort of like a reading the tea leaves kind of question. I mean, in the terms of the tax bombs, presumably if a bunch of people owed that as you know, consumer protection attorneys, a lot of people are not going to be able to pay those tax bombs, you know?
No, I mean, so I agree with you that I think they're going to, if I had to place a bet, I think that they would eliminate the taxability of loan forgiveness under the 20 or 25 year terms for income driven plan. As for the 5 or 10%, they already addressed that. They opened up the pay as you earn plan by creating the revised pay as you earn plan. It certainly is a little bit different from pay as you earn, but borrowers who are in the direct loan program already have access to a 10% income plan. So I don't really see opening up pay as you earn to everyone doesn't really change the landscape for the vast majority of people. I think you'll see either a shorter repayment term, maybe you'll see a reduction in the percentage coupled with maybe more robust access to other loan forgiveness programs like public service loan forgiveness. Maybe they'll create or streamline some other discharge options for folks who were defrauded by their schools or have some other basis for not being able to repay their debts, and opening up bankruptcy to some extent as well. I think all of that is reasonable in terms of possible reform outcomes, but obviously much of this, if not all of it, is really dependent on the outcome of the 2020 election, not just in terms of the presidential election, but in particular, what Congress looks like.
Yeah. Jay, what do you think? Read the tea leaves for us.
I agree. I think that the major change that is likely to happen is going to be with respect to the tax bomb. And I think that there are a couple of reasons for it. First of all, as I tell my clients, everybody hates the IRS now anyway. Can you imagine what sort of uproar there's going to be if in 20 some odd years, there's $18 bazillion trillion worth of unpaid tax debt out there? add to the fact that past due federal and state income tax debt is dischargeable in bankruptcy. There are some time restrictions to it and some, you know, you've got to time your filing properly, but it's dischargeable in bankruptcy. You can handle it in a way that you're currently not able to handle federal student loan debt standing alone. So I think that in order to reconcile those positions, there's going to have to be something done with respect to that tax bomb. And the last reason why I think that that's the most likely outcome is everybody who is just beginning their federal student loan repayment journey at this point, in 20 years, they're going to be the core constituencies of every single congressperson, senator. I mean, these are going to be the influencers. And I don't mean that in an Instagram way of saying it. These are going to be the people that actually are contributing big money to political campaigns when that isn't quite the case now. And I think that, look, money talks.
Yeah.
Just is what it is.
I wouldn't want to piss off the dentist that talks to, you know, 1,000 people in my community, you know, about, you know, which person should you not vote for, right? You don't want to make the neighborhood dentists hate you. I think that's kind of why we tell people to be prepared for the tax bomb, but like realize when you're trying to debate whether or not you refinance or keep it on a federal program, you want to model as if that tax bomb completely went away when you're comparing that to a federal program to make sure you're making the right decision, you know, about refinancing versus not. Do you guys get a lot of useless email from people like, I hate Fed Loan, I want to sue, or Jay, include me on the class action against Navient? Tell me what the difference is between something that's like useful to contact you for and something that's people just emotionally venting about how frustrating this all is.
Oh, I get a lot of angry grams. How about you, Adam?
All the time, yeah. You know, the reality is that not everything that is unfair provides a legal basis for a lawsuit. And not everything that provides a legal basis for a lawsuit is going to result in any meaningful changes to a borrower's situation. It doesn't mean that, you know, that litigation isn't worth it. Sometimes it certainly is. We just got a fantastic decision. I want to say out of one of the circuits, I don't remember, I'm going to be writing about it soon, but you know, it's about being able to sue your loan servicers for certain forms of misrepresentations. But bottom line is it's complicated. It's very fact specific. You know, Jay and I face what is a very unfair system daily. If you think you've been wronged and you think that, you know, you were harmed in some way, absolutely reach out to someone and try to get some assistance. But I think, you know, the biggest misconception is that sadly, just because something didn't go right with your loans, it doesn't necessarily mean that you've got a basis to wipe out your debt or sue your loan servicer for millions of dollars. Unfortunately, there's some expectation of that.
Yeah, I agree. People are brought up with the notion that the legal system is designed to provide justice. And that may or may not be true depending upon who you speak to, but the reality is that the legal system is designed with an objective standard in mind, not supposed to cater to one individual's situation or one individual's problem. With respect to class actions, I think that they serve a tremendous good in society because they're designed to encourage private citizens and private attorneys to bring to the court's attention societal wrongs or widespread wrongs. They are not, however, designed for individual compensation or to make an individual whole. And that's one of the major reasons why you look at any class action and you see that the problem may be alleviated, but members of the class get a $4 gift card or something very small because it's not designed for individual to right individual wrongs. And a lot of people don't realize that.
One thing that kind of differentiates talking to somebody like me versus talking to somebody like you is, you know, especially the way I view it is if you have private student loans in default, and especially if they've been in default for a while, you know, I mean, that's like a no-brainer to contact a student loan attorney, right? Can you both talk about some of the private student loan relief that you've gotten people and why?
So when it comes to private student loans that are in default, there are different strategies for dealing with it. You know, I've had clients where we've waited it out and it's become time barred by the statute of limitations. Doesn't mean the debt necessarily goes away, but it effectively becomes under non-collectible or uncollectible, at least under state law, because the lender basically, you know, waited too long. In some cases, you can raise defenses in response to private loan collections or private loan litigation. Sometimes they don't have sufficient documentation to prove the debt. Sometimes the debt has been bought and sold a bunch of times and, you know, they don't have the paperwork to back it up. Sometimes there are legitimate defenses that you can raise based on fraud, for instance, or forgery in some cases. And you can fight them on that. And if you prevail, you could potentially get the suit dismissed. And if you get the suit dismissed, then, you know, you don't have to pay it. You know, I try to set expectations with people. That is possible. And I have gotten those outcomes and I'm, you know, proud of those outcomes. But more often than not, private loan litigation will often end in some sort of negotiated outcome, a settlement, a payment plan. Often, you know, if you're able to leverage something, you can get a decent outcome, even with a settlement or a payment plan, where you get a substantial reduction in the amount owed. You can avoid the worst case scenario debt collection outcomes, like property attachments and asset seizures and wage garnishments. I view those as good outcomes as well. If we can save our clients a good chunk of money and protect them from the worst case scenario stuff, I view that as a victory. Generally speaking, if you're in collections for any reason, talking to an attorney can be useful at a minimum, just to get a sense of what your options are, what your legal rights are, what the best and worst case scenarios are, and everything in between. And you can develop a strategy for how you're going to address it. For federal loans, that might involve rehabilitation or consolidation. For private loans, it might involve litigating or waiting or negotiating. But, you know, certainly being in collections, I think, is a good time to get some counsel.
I agree. The problem with private student loans in a litigation context is that though the holder may have problems with their ability to prove ownership or their ability to account for the total balance that they claim to be due, is that ultimately a judge is going to make the decision. And judges are human like everybody else is, and they come to the table with their own sets of expectations. Some judges will give a student loan holder a little bit more leeway in the amount of documentation that's required to prove the case. Some will not give them more leeway. And so that's something that I think every borrower needs to consider. And also, don't discount the value of bankruptcy, not necessarily to discharge the debt, but either A, to be able to wipe out other debts and therefore free up some more money to be able to take care of your student loans, or to be able to go into a bankruptcy that involves a repayment over a period of time of a portion of your debt as a means of reorganizing your finances and giving you the opportunity to take a deep breath and kind of fall back and regroup. There are also some other ways that bankruptcy does help people, particularly in what's called a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, which is a repayment bankruptcy. There are means of effectively turning the tables on lenders, particularly private lenders, to turn what would otherwise be a defense in a state court action into an offense in bankruptcy court. And we've had some really good success in that respect as well, to be able to either negotiate private student debt down, or in some cases, just to wipe it out altogether. But as in childhood games, it takes a steady hand. And I agree with Adam that these are the times that you really want to be able to sit down with an attorney.
Well, yeah, and especially if you're in default on private student loans, you definitely need that expertise, because we've had clients that have had collection agencies reach out to them, I think, on uncollectible debt, trying to get them to make a payment, or they're 6 years, or they're 5 years, 6 years in, like almost at the point of statute of limitations expiring, and that making that payment resets that clock. And so, you know, these groups really get creative with trying to kind of, they know the consumer rules and they know what line they're allowed to go up to. And how are you going to know that line if you don't have somebody like one of you guys on your side with that kind of thing? So let's throw a dangerous hypothetical out. I just want to see what you guys say. So let's say we've got this couple, both of them making like 50 grand. Very unlikely they're going to make more than that, you know, so about 100 grand total household income. But together they have, let's say, 200,000 of private debt. And they also have, you know, another 50,000 each of federal debt. So 300K of debt total. These private loan payments, they're like 2 grand a month. I mean, after taxes, that's like a third of their income. And let's say they're in New York. So that's both a state where you both are licensed. So, I mean, in this case, let's say they've defaulted. They're about a year into the default, given the limited information that I gave you.
It's very specific limited information.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to throw out a case that would apply to, it's an amalgam of clients that we've had in the past several months, let's say. What kind of ammunition do you have? I mean, you know, somebody that's making 100K household income, I mean, they could put a third of their income towards their private loans, right? But then they have those federal loans as well. So I'm just wondering, like, what your initial mindset would be if somebody like that came to you for help. What would maybe be some of the things that you would want to investigate or think about?
You said that, if I heard you correctly, that the private loans are already in default, right? So
sure.
If that wasn't the case, we would want to evaluate what are the implications of defaulting versus repaying. Should we explore refinancing? Would that ease the pressure, you know, financially for you? Do you have other options for staying current and preserving your credit? But if they're already in default, that's already out the window. So if that's the case, then the question is it in collections? Have you been contacted by debt collectors? What does that look like? Is it with a law firm? Have you been sued? You know, and then if not, what do you have in terms of financial resources? Is a settlement possible now to head off a lawsuit? Is that something that you want to do? If not, can we develop a savings plan so that we can potentially be in a position to settle? Who is the lender? Are there any possible defenses that can be raised if they do pursue you? So all of that would be part of the conversation. And you know, essentially, I think the universe of options are fairly limited. Do you sort of ignore it and wait to see what they do, knowing that there is a time limit for how long they have to pursue you? Do you affirmatively try to head off further collections and try to negotiate a settlement now? Do you set aside money in some sort of savings arrangement or savings plan and take a more defensive posture? And that way you've got resources to tap into if and when the time is right, either when you save enough to be able to approach them to settle, or if they wait too long, the debt becomes time barred, or if they sue you, maybe you can negotiate a settlement or have enough resources to be able to hire an attorney and defend yourself. You know, and we would kind of, I think, work out all of those details and options and considerations to try to figure out what is best for them. Should they hire an attorney now, which can shield them from certain types of debt collection actions and communications, or should we, you know, wait until things get more dire? These are all things that I think would be part of the analysis. Also, who is the lender, right? Is it someone that is likely to be successful in a debt collection lawsuit? Is it someone that is likely to sue, unlikely to sue, has difficulty proving that they own the debt if it's a debt buyer? There's a lot that I think we would want to consider. And then, of course, the X factor is something like bankruptcy. You know, do they have other debts in addition to student loan debt that could be discharged in bankruptcy? Is that something worth pursuing? Is it worth it to try for an adversary proceeding? So there's a lot to consider, I think.
But I don't want to pay it. I want it to go away.
I always tell people, if there was a button that I could press for you to make your student debt just disappear, I would press that button, but no such button exists. So we only have the options that are available to us right now, and we got to work within those options.
But that was a lot. Jay, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I do kind of. I think that Adam and I would both agree that the first thing that you want to deal with are the federal student loans. And regardless of anything else, you want to make sure that you take every action possible to keep those federal student loans out of default, particularly in light of the fact that the federal student loans come with enforcement opportunities that don't include litigation. And for some people, it feels more draconian. Once those federal student loans are taken care of, the real question is one of risk tolerance. It's just like any investment strategy. What's your risk tolerance? Are you willing to put yourself in a position of continued default on these private student loans? Are you in a position, are you willing to deal with the collection activities that are going to continue for whatever period of time it is? And are you comfortable with that lack of certainty? When are they going to sue? Are they going to sue? What are they going to do next? Are you comfortable with not knowing what comes next? Beyond that, what's the goal here? What are you really looking to accomplish? Are you really looking to just minimize the amount of money that you're going to be paying? Are you more focused on your long-term investment and saving strategies? Do you have other debts? For some people, bankruptcy makes sense to be able to bring them into that universe of certainty, at least for the short term, the 3 to 5 year term, to be able to start building themselves up. One thing that I tell my clients with private student loans in default is, even if you were to pay the loan in full today while it is in default, you don't get a cookie for that. You don't get a pat on the head for paying that private student debt off. And when I say that, I mean to say that your credit score is still negatively impacted because you had the default. It's still sitting there. I know that there's the whole line of thinking of pay for delete and things like that. But in the absence of that, you're still going to contend with a reduced credit score. You are potentially, if you're not paying it off in full, and instead you're going to be settling it for a lesser balance to bring the account to zero, that's going to have negative credit implications. More to the point, if you're in default because you're having financial difficulties, either it's short-term or you think that it's going to be going on for a long time, you can't pay your rent or your mortgage with the paid in full bill from your private student loan. And so you need to be able to allocate your resources in the way that makes the most sense to you. And as Adam said, it's really a very fact-specific situation, but you've got to be able to take into account all of your goals and what your life is going to look like.
That's great. I have one last question. Is there anything in particular about COVID-19, the CARES Act, that borrowers that are in default should know in terms of any kind of benefits or protections or things that they could do right now? We'll take this to Adam first.
Sure. I mean, so the CARES Act is great for certain borrowers. So for borrowers who have Department of Education held federal loans, which are direct loans, and certain other federal loans that have been acquired by the Department of Ed, does several things. So number one, all collections is suspended on those loans for 6 months through September 30th. That means no collections efforts, no wage garnishments, no tax refund seizures, no Social Security offsets, and any seizures or offsets that occurred after March 13th can be refunded back to the borrower. It doesn't get you out of default, but it does pause all collections efforts for the next 6 months. For borrowers in good standing on those loans, it suspends automatically all payments through September 30th. Also, all interest is suspended for both borrowers in good standing and borrowers in default. You can choose to make payments if you want, but if you don't make payments, for borrowers in default and who were already in a rehabilitation plan, those months of suspended payments should still count towards loan rehabilitation if they were already in one of those programs. Although some debt collection agencies have not gotten specific guidance on that yet, so we're still trying to work out the kinks of that. For borrowers in good standing, the months of suspended payments would still count towards loan forgiveness programs. That includes loan forgiveness on the 20 to 25 year terms for income-driven repayment plans, and also for the public service loan forgiveness program as well. So in other words, normally being in a forbearance or some sort of suspended payment situation pauses your progress towards loan forgiveness programs. That's not the case here, which is great. Of course, not all federal loans are covered. Guaranteed loans, FFELP program loans that are not held by the Department of Ed are left out of this, as are Perkins loans. And of course, private loans are left out as well. Individual lenders and guarantors have been offering some voluntary relief, like brief forbearances, things like that. You'd have to check with your servicer or loan holder for more information on that. But it's not as robust as the protections offered by the CARES Act.
That's good. Anything to add, Jay?
Yeah. Understanding that private loans are outside of the universe of the federal regulations, and they are subject to state laws. And a variety of states have either suspended statutes of limitations during the period of time that they've got national, either their shelter in place law active, or during the period of national emergency, which effectively increases the amount of time that a private lender would have to bring legal action against a borrower. Some states have actually gone ahead and secured some relief for private student loan borrowers. Most notably, New York reached an agreement with Navient, Nelnet, FIA, which is also AES, Mohila, and a couple of other servicers. Actually, 90% of privately held student loans that includes deferred collection of payments for 90 days, waived late fees only upon borrower request, no negative data reported to credit bureau agencies, and a variety of other things for people impacted by COVID-19. That only applies to borrowers in New York, and it's specific to the private servicers that in some situations may be more than the private servicers are voluntarily extending to borrowers in other states. It is really important that as much as borrowers do not want to pick up the phone and sit on hold for hours and talk to their private student loan servicer, I know for a fact that nobody wants to talk to their private student loan servicer ever. It's just not a pleasant thing. But at this moment in time, it is of critical importance that you take that deep breath and you pick up the phone and you find out what is available to you. Again, as Adam said, it's not as nearly as robust as what's in the CARES Act, but something's better than nothing. And sometimes you've got to take what you can get.
That's great. So last question is, where can people find out about you and what you do and contact you, and who should be contacting you for potentially working with you? So we'll start with Adam and then we'll ask the same to Jay.
Sure. Yeah. So best way to find me is through my website, minsky-law.com. That's MINSKY-LAW.com. You could also just go to bostonstudentloanlawyer.com or just Google my name, Adam Minsky, MINSKY. I also write for Forbes. You can find me on my Forbes column as well. If you live in New York and Massachusetts, that's where I'm licensed. So it's very possible I can, you know, help you. It obviously depends on the specifics. Outside of those states, I'm much more restricted in what I can do. Depending on the state and the specific facts, if the loans are federal, I might be able to provide some guidance and counsel. Again, very much fact-specific and state-specific. I have a blog. I write for Forbes. I also do some guest posts and guest writing elsewhere as well. So you can just Google me and you'll find me, but the website is the best way to reach me.
Jay?
And for me, best way to find me is either moneywiselaw.com, or I've also got a podcast, studentloanshow.com. Feel free to Google me as well. I'm pretty much on all of the major platforms, and I am one of two Jay Fleischmans, I believe. There's another one who's an ophthalmologist, I think, who's in the Bronx. But I think I outrank him for the name at this point.
Yeah, don't reach out to him for student loan help. Right. That's great. So really, you know, if you're in default, reach out to these guys, because if they can't help you, you know, they're very well connected. They know somebody maybe in your state specifically, or they might know somebody that could get you some counsel and some advice. Adam and Jay, thank you so much again for being on the Student Loan Planner podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Travis.
And that's the end of today's show. If you know that you need a student loan plan, get one set up today at studentloanplanner.com/book. If you know that you need to refinance your loans, check out studentloanplanner.com/refi, R-E-F-I, and get a cashback bonus so you can start saving money in your interest today. And finally, if you like the show, leave us a review in the favorite place that you listen to podcasts, or share it with someone who owes more than you.